You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to Ross Noble, who many of you will know, many of you in the UK certainly, and in Australia I'm sure he tours extensively, and those of you listening further afield, some of you might know him too as an incredible improviser. I mean, what he does is just going to blow your mind, really. If you're not familiar with him, he's able to release DVDs that have 6 or 7 shows from the same tour with almost no repeat of material because he just opens his mouth and it comes out. He's going to tell us all about that in just a second. As you'll hear, he's a fan of the show and he asked to come on. So I was really, really grateful to have him. We spoke for about 2 hours and I just don't have the bandwidth, whatever that is, to release the entire 2 hour thing as a weekly episode. So I have split it into a 2-parter. So I never know whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, whether you're like, oh, come on, man, put the whole 2 hours out. I just can't. It's too memory-ish. Ask a friend to explain it to you. Someone explained it to me and I loosely understand. So equally, you might be thinking, well, this is fantastic because I get half of it now. It's going to end on a cliffhanger, and then I'll get to listen to it next week. So this is the first part of a really invigorating conversation with a very funny man indeed. This is Ross Noble. So we're here in Birmingham in a very swanky hotel, and I'm...
Did you have to mention it was a swanky
hotel? Yeah, it is a swanky hotel, and not only is it a swanky hotel, but what I love is that, like any road act, you haven't unpacked, your stuff's all in a bag, and it's
exactly.
2 nights here and off I fuck.
Yeah.
You're on tonight at the New Alexandra Theatre, and you're on in, what is it now, it's 4:30, you're sound checking...
Yeah, about half six.
About half
o'clock.
Six. And then the show's, what, at 8?
Yes, yes.
So where are we in the process of your getting ready for a show?
I'm terrible. I don't really get ready for a show in terms of I can be sort of... Well, no, that's not true, actually. I'll go to the theatre about half six, 7 o'clock, and then the tour manager will go off and get Nando's. And then bring me Nando's. And then, or if there isn't a Nando's in the town, I have 2 whole chickens. That's my rider.
What's your Nando's order?
I go a bit off the books. I go, do you know the Perry Tamer?
No, I eat a lot of Nando's, but I'm strictly lemon and herb. Mango and lime. I like mango and lime.
Perry Tamer is what they have for kids. You know how, like, even the mild is quite spicy.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So Perry Tamer is this sort of slightly sugary type sauce it's basically off the kids' menu.
Okay.
But if you say Perry... Oh, that's the hang on. Sorry. That's the
For the benefit of the listener, Ross has just received a delivery from a charming young man in a waistcoat I think that's a tuna niçoise salad.
It is.
And
yes.
It's colossal.
Would you like it?
No, I'm fine, thanks, man.
It
looks
it.
Good, though. It's got those kind of poached eggs where they're sort of, you can tell that they're still soft in the middle and then,
I ordered it quite a long time ago and it's taken this long.
The first half of this interview will commence with the sound of Niswa's crunching in the
background.
Everyone
is Noble had a stroke. He goes, right, I'm going to leave that.
Eat when you need to.
God, no. Look, how fat is that? The fact that I was in the middle of talking about having chicken delivered and then more food around. So I get my food delivered and then I... that's about... About 7 o'clock, and then I'll do a sound check. Doors open 7:30. About 7:45, I put a shirt on, strap, get my mic all on,
Okay.
tape it to my head, and then sit there just reading the paper and talking to
okay.
the tour manager.
Okay.
And then it's quite good because I've got like a bit of a crew, you know. So we all just sort of the thing about touring, like the thing about sort of touring on your own, is this thing of having. It can be like really lonely because you just end up it's just you on your own. So I've got like there's five of us. So I've basically replaced what would be acting in a dressing room. I've just replaced them with, you know, I've got a guy that does the merch. I've got a tour manager, production manager, another guy that does my bits and bobs, electronic-y stuff. So, yeah, so we just all sit around and then...
Excellent. And do you have similar conversations to those you'd have in a dressing room? Are you sort of bitching about motorways?
No, there's very little bitching at the moment. There's two of the crew are... they basically have this obsession with sort of like weird hypothetical sexual situations. The last of which was basically one of them. It's a long story, but the tour manager we're convinced that he got pleasured by a ghost. It's a long story, but basically I can't tell you the full story because it's a bit too weird, but we were at essentially a haunted house and he was having a piss, and then so it's just developed into that he was pleasured by a ghost and we won't leave it alone. So it's this constant thing of him.
So basically, so that is like backstage in a club. You're bullying if you've picked a member of the team.
It's a gentle conversational bullying.
Yeah.
And then we've got this sort of this ongoing thing about if you had sex with the like an invisible woman, what would be the visual effect of it on you downstairs? Would your bits disappear? And this has been going on now. We're about a month into the tour, and we've just so it's basically ghosts and invisible women.
So it's going to sound like to any of your fans listening to this that this is a continuation, but it's like this is exactly what you're doing on stage.
Sometimes I'll go on stage, and the audience has no idea that I'm continuing the conversation from the dressing room. But yeah, so I'll sometimes go on. And deliberately put some of the stuff. Essentially, what I'm saying is I've got a load of funny mates who I just nick ideas.
We're straight into the process.
So that's So we just sort of we sit around. But I'm sort of quite I'm quite laid back about the whole thing. So sometimes I can be like it can be like 2 minutes too, and like I'll you know if I've got people come around beforehand, I can just be chatting, and my tour manager's going. We're literally starting in, you know, like we're starting in 5 minutes. And I go, all right, okay. And then I'll just wander through and go on. So I'm not like one of these that sort of...
You're not pacing up and down. You're not going, right, get all my weird ideas in order.
I do pace up and down, but that's more just to... I have to go behind the set
okay.
and sort of stand there to hear the audience. Because sometimes it's this weird thing of like if the show relay is coming through the speaker in the dressing room and I can hear the music and I can hear
the bustle,
you can hear the crowd. I'm there going, all right, yeah, okay, right, it's gig happening. But if you get to a place where, for whatever reason, they haven't got the show relay on or there's some sort of, or you can't hear the, you know, if you're miles away or you've gone for a dressing room that hasn't got one, I can sometimes be in there and he can come in and go 5 minutes and I'll go, oh God, now I haven't even got my shirt on. So that's pretty much the sort of build up. The bit, it's not like I've never really been one of these people who sort of like spends all day going, oh God, like, oh my God, I've got a show to do. It's always just...
And this is particularly interesting given the nature of the show you do. So for people who haven't seen your shows before, like it might be people listening in far-off distant lands that you've not toured.
Yeah.
What you do is... I mean, you're basically your own genre, aren't you?
Now, obviously, the danger of this podcast is that you start going up your own arse. So I don't... don't really define what I do, because then it just makes me sound like I'm being a dick.
Can you for us, because it's this show, and as I said, we've not mentioned on the show yet, I'm very gratified, very pleased that you're a listener of the show, and you emailed me with the correct code phrase.
Yes, that's right.
So that proves you're a listener, so thank you.
Well,
for
I actually was going to, I don't know if I did in the end, I said I was going to make some sort of references to getting it on with your daughters.
Yeah.
And I just sort of said, and I thought, oh God, I hope nobody's hacking into my email.
It's a tough one to explain. So given that it's us,
right,
can you
okay.
give me a phone, go there, be a dick about it?
Well, it's difficult because here's the thing, right? And the thing that, like, when people talk about, like, what I do, there's certain things that come up, to me, like labels that people want to put on it. And I'm quite, this
go on.
You're going to have to edit out me just thinking. Can I just say as well, right, having listened to this podcast loads of times before as well, if anyone's tuned into this and they've tuned in specifically because I'm on and not for the podcast, there's going to be nothing funny. I will say nothing funny in the next bit, because that's the thing, when I talk about comedy, it's like the dullest thing ever. Here's the thing.
You were talking about the labels that people put on your...
Yeah. People want to sort of like, you know, they want to sort of like, you know, surreal and, you know, improv, and they want to put, you know, all these different things. And I just want people to come along and see the show. Like, they're just coming to see stand-up. They're just coming to see a stand-up comedian. You know, it's a bit like when you sort of, you know, if you went to see, see Billy Connolly, right? And again, it's like, I know it's a danger in sort of drawing comparisons or whatever, but you wouldn't go along to see Billy Connolly and go, I'm going to go along and see Billy Connolly, the, you know, you might see a Scottish comedian. You know,
sure.
There might, you know, you would just...
You're not going to say, I fancy some anecdotalism tonight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, gotcha. So, you know, you sort of, and even sort of, even people that kind of... I was thinking I get a bit wound up when people go, even like, oh, he's a political comedian. You know, people that sort of set their stall out as this thing. And even though what I do is a thing, I don't want people to go... I know some people probably come along and go, we're going because of that. Essentially, if you haven't seen me before, it's me, it's stand-up, but it's me sort of playing. That's what I've sort of boiled it down to. It's me just... it's dicking about is what it is, but it's sort of... It's loose, it's anecdotal, it's improvised, it's really hard to... It's just me taking about. but it's weird, because...
We're zeroing in on it. Is it that differentiates it to seeing someone else dick about? Like, we've seen someone compare on stage.
Yeah, but I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's fair to put that on. I don't think I should be the one to define it, because it's one of those things where that then implies that... Basically, I decided that when I first started, I tried really hard to be what I thought a comic was supposed to be, because I thought that's what an audience wants. But what I'd, and also to try and find like a voice, you know, so, oh, am I this sort of comedian? Am I high energy? Am I low energy? Am I deadpan? Am I this? Do I sound like this? And I was sort of, you know, try all these different things. And then there was a point where I kind of went, you know what? I won't be any of that. I won't try and do that. I'll just go on there, and I'll just be a sort of an everyman, you know, I'll just sort of be myself, which in my head I thought, well, that's just this sort of, what is it? There's nothing, there's no thing there. There's nothing, that's just like every other sort of, you know, every other stand-up that you see. It wasn't until I started doing that that people went, you know what you're doing, you know that's what you do. And I went, ah, oh, right. Okay. And really it was just, I think what I do is sort of, it's sort of come out of, in a way, it's sort of just, it wasn't like I sat down and went, I'm going to do this thing and it's going to be, you know, as you put it, like my own genre or whatever.
Sure.
It's one of those things where it sort of comes from how I got to where it is now. It's all these sort of layers that have come to that thing. And so it's very hard for me to go, this is my mission statement. This is what I do. It's like layer on layer and layer of years of just kind of going, oh, well, this interests me. Oh, that would be fun to do. I'll just do this now. Oh, and then the gigs that I've done and the type of performance, and it's organically turned into this thing. And it's very hard for me to... I know this is a real cop-out of an answer, it's very hard for me to go, this is what I do.
Sure.
Because what I do has become... It's one of those things where it's become far more... I don't think about, you know, I think about what I'm doing, but it's not like, you know, some people sit down and they go, I'm going to do this, I'm going to be a political comedian, or I'm going to be this sort of comedian, and that's not how it works. Completely gone the other way. It's become this sort of intuitive thing that I've sort of got to, and then people go, it's only when people review the show, or when people come to it who've never seen me before, or they bring friends along and they go, you know, and those people go, if you have it, you know, if you haven't seen the sort of development of it, it's just this thing.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where, you know, it's not like somebody can come along, and that's what's good, because I've sort of future-proofed myself in a way. It's not like somebody starting to do stand-up can come along and go, I'm going to do that. Because you can't sort of.
This is a safe space.
It's one of those things where it'd be very hard to just sort of shortcut to what I do because you'd sort of have you could do it, but it's all about how you get. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think what you're describing is. The process of, in inverted commas, finding your voice.
Mm.
I think it sounds like you were sidetracked, as I think so many people are, myself included. I am going through this, I think, in a moment. Is you the process of finding your voice, it's almost like you feel, as a newer comic, like you have to decide who you are and then go and do the thing you've decided to do. And actually, you let go of it and you go, oh, fuck this, I'm just going to do I'm just going to be me. And then you go, oh, for Christ's sake, it was there all along, that's the thing.
Exactly. But also, I think it's harder now, more than ever, it's harder now to allow yourself to... The pressure now... to be fully formed straight away is almost sort of ridiculous, you know. And there's a few comics who have come along, you know, in the past few years who are great comics, who have sort of come along fully formed, and what they did, you know, they've arrived, and you know, you go, oh, that's who they are, that's what they do, but the end result isn't necessarily as interesting as what they will be in 20 years' time.
Or is where they would end up were they not suddenly being rewarded financially and with audiences for the decisions they've made.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
That's not to say what the... You know, I mean, you know, to be fair, you look at somebody like... I mean, like Peter Kay's classic example. Mm. Like, Peter Kay, literally, he came fully formed. There was no... You know, like, you see, you know, Peter doing an open spot... is what you would see now in an arena. There was no, there was no sort of, you know, finding his voice and all the rest of it. But actually, you know, that was, you know, but what he does is so, you know, it's so sort of perfectly formed. It's not like he's there going, oh yeah, but what I really want to do is you know, I really want to get to the angst underneath this. He doesn't care about that.
Sure.
So, you know, so yeah, so that's sort of, that's, you know, it's a good thing, it's a bad thing, but, you know, like I say, yeah, you sort of going through that to arrive. But there again, you know, you get people like Rob Newman, you know, you couldn't find a more, you know, accessible, you know, he was an impressionist, he used to do all the, you know, he used to come out and do, you know, impressions, and then he was on a youth comedy, you know, Mary Whitehouse experience, where it was all very much, you know, it was appealing to a sort of a teen type audience, and it was great what they were doing and all the rest of it. But then he, you know, he got there, and then there was the switch, and he went, oh, actually, and then he went and found the...
That's really rare, isn't it, for someone to go, this is, I'm being rewarded here, I'm being told by the industry and the bank balance that I'm doing the right thing. And to actually go, nope, I want to nip this in the bud, change, do something else, and learn. I remember in a sort of a smaller context, Joe Wilkinson. I don't know if you know Joe Wilkinson.
Yeah, very funny.
We started around the same time.
Right.
And he definitely did a thing where he was starting to get paid and starting to do well in clubs, and just went, what am I doing? Right, what am I doing? Okay. I'm doing the wrong thing here. I'm gonna leave my agent. I'm gonna stop being paid, and I'm gonna go back to exploring and finding what I do. But, as a result, he's now found something. But really interesting.
But what I love about him, I'm a big fan of his actually. What I love about him is the fact that he's almost done that thing that, in a way, sort of similar to Harry Hill, of doing something that's flies in the face of mainstream, you know, the mainstream idea of what a comedian should be. And then, you know, with the stuff that he did on the count, you know, the countdown.
Yeah, comedians in Canada,
Because of that, and I haven't seen him on it, but I saw an ad, and the fact that he's been booked to do Celebrity Squares. Now, I love that. I love the fact that, like, he's gone, I'm going to do the most, you know, I'm going to go completely in the face of the mainstream. And then the mainstream turns around and goes, oh, he's really good on that countdown show.
Should we
book him for Celebrity Squares? And then all of a sudden, you know, and then it's...
He's doing it on his own terms.
He's doing it on his own terms, and that's—I think that's brilliant. I love that. And you know, Harry Hill's exactly the same. You know, you sort of watch. I always thought, you know, Harry Hill and also the Little Britain lads as well. You know, if you go back 15, 20 years, you'd look at their acts and just go, "There's no way they're going to be mainstream entertainers." That's just clubs, people just sort of splitting rooms and stuff, and then all of a sudden. They're, you know, they become the most mainstream entertainers on telly, still doing what they do. And I think that's sort of for anyone who's, and I didn't think of Joe Wilkinson, but yeah, I think anyone that's sort of, you know, desperate to, is lucky, you know, if people that are sort of doing the gigs and thinking, oh, I've got to basically do exactly what is required of me to get on.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, there could be exceptions to the rule, but I think that's a classic example of you're actually better off doing something that's so different that, I mean, obviously some people do stuff that's so different they feel, I'm not touching that. But, you know, you find... Yeah. But I think it's happened a few times. I mean, Stuart Lee's another example, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Stuart's sort of, you know, sort of the ultimate sort of comics comic, but you look back at... You know, and I loved the Fist of Fun stuff, but, you know, if you look back at that stuff, it was all, you know, it was, you know, appealing to the younger people and all, and Sean Hughes as well, you know, I mean, like, Sean Hughes, who, you know, he, I mean, you know, now he's sort of become this, you know, he takes himself very seriously and he talks about his emotions and all the rest of it, but if you look at his early stuff, you know, he was a, you know, he's very good stand-up, he was great, but ultimately he appealed to teenage girls and then he was on a pop quiz and then he sort of packed in stand-up the first chance that he could get and he was all very, you know, he sort of, you know, just went off and then now he's kind of hit that point where he's gone, oh, actually, no, I want to do, you know, now he's, you know, talking about his feelings and, that's terrible. Nice to know where I am.
I think one of the things I love about Ross is how he's built all of this himself. hand kind of brick by brick over time. You know, later on we'll be talking about his work ethic and the way that he built up a live following. And it's really extraordinary. I mean, obviously the landscape of comedy was very different when he started, but he has absolutely from day one known exactly what he wanted to achieve and then stuck into achieving it hammer and tongs. I suppose it probably helps when you haven't got to write any sodding material, Ross. But there we go. So I hope you're enjoying this. We didn't get, needless to say, we didn't get everything that I wanted to talk about. There's loads of stuff about Meatface, about his stuff on the Apollo, about how he handles panel shows, things like that. Lots more stuff to talk about. And some of that we didn't get around to even in episode in the second half of this one. So what we'll do, we both agreed, we were happy to keep chatting, except I had to basically stop the show in time for him to get to his gig on time that night. And by his gig, I mean a sold out show in a massive theatre. We agreed that we'd do another, like a part two or a part one and a half, or part 2B or something, when we can. So maybe that'll be in a year or so, or we'll hook back up and see what else Ross has to say, because I'd be very interested to hear it. Now, I just wanted to tell you before we moved on with the rest of this conversation, I went to a drag show the other night. Oh, prepared for me to get all excited. If you're on the Facebook group, you'll have noticed that my current profile picture is looking fierce in a neon wig, which I thought would be a mistake. My girlfriend did an incredible job of my makeup, and I have to admit, I surprised myself by how kind of moany and complaining I was when she was doing it. Even me, listeners, this is I'm sort of quite quite up for some of that stuff, as you know. But I was all sort of, oh, I'm gonna look stupid. I got there, we went to see Sharon Needles, who was a fantastic contender on season four, I think, of RuPaul's Drag Race. We saw her at the Black Cap in Camden for my girlfriend's birthday. And it was an absolutely mind-blowing show. If you've never been to a drag show, it's absolutely worth seeking out a really good one. And I just wanted to just take 2 seconds just to talk about, I mean, I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm effectively advertising for free, mind. No money has changed hands here. I just want to advertise RuPaul's Drag Race, because many of you will know my feelings on reality shows. This is the only one I'm prepared to watch. I won't even watch Come Dine With Me. There is so much heart in this guy and in the show that he's created. You know, I like my secret societies and subcultures and languages and stuff. If you watch this show, you will learn all about throwing shade, taking a trip to the library, what it means to be fishy, all of this wonderful subculture codification. I just absolutely love it. But and the reason I mention this, I'm not just waffling. I am waffling, but I also have a reason to mention this, which is that I genuinely think you can learn something about stand-up from watching a bunch of, I mean, I don't know what they start off, I think with 13 drag queens, all men, nearly all gay, I think. And you can learn something about the difference between their performative persona and who they are off stage. And it's almost because you're not watching it from a comedy point of view, it's very funny frequently, but you're not watching them as comedians. You can sit back. I felt I was able to kind of turn off some of my sort of relentless analytical approach to stand-up and actually get a sense of, oh, look, some of these performers, you can see them on stage giving it their all. And then others of them you can see on stage giving their all whilst showing a little bit of their real self, whilst showing some actual vulnerability. And that is something that I struggled with when I was on, I did a reality show that I talked about briefly with Prince Abdi last week called Show Me the Funny a few years ago. And I really felt so caged by the confines of the show that I, you know, you weren't allowed to mention, I'll go into this at a later date properly, but you know, you're not allowed to mention the experience of being filmed ever, because then it becomes too meta vortexy. So not just an interview, but also performatively watching this. I can't recommend it enough. It's loads of fun. But watching the Drag Race show, you get a sense of, as I said, stepped back from a stand-up perspective, you go, ah, this person is just being big and performy. Whereas this person is being big and performative and sort of incandescent and, you know, sort of exciting and energetic. But you can also see right into them and there's a twinkle in their eye and just something in the way they perform. A subtlety that that you just, I don't know, man. There's no way for me to, if you're listening to this thinking, Stuart's talking about going to see a drag show or a reality TV show with drag queens, there is literally no link between this and comedy, but you're wrong. So check it out, because I think it's a really good way of seeing. It's a really good framework within which to experience persona, which is something we talk about a lot. I am very excited. In fact, I found out this week that in Christchurch at the World Buskers Festival, which I'm doing in New Zealand in January, one of the ex-competitors of the show, Jinx Monsoon, is going to be performing a show there as well. I am going to try and peg her for a chat. Obviously, I'm sneakily going to try and befriend her first, but I will try and grab her and see if she fancies coming on the podcast. RuPaul will be bringing the drag race to the UK. You're going to think I'm a corporate shill. I'm absolutely not. No one's paying me to say this, but I'm excited to try and get RuPaul on this show as well, because he is a funny guy and a very, very savvy media operator. And I find more and more with this show and the work I'm doing, and the sort of the advice that some of you might be interested in, not that I ever deign to give you advice myself, I'll leave that to my guests, but I think the more I do the podcast, the more connected I am to the internet and the opportunities therein, I am just more and more convinced that it's all just there for us. It's just there for the taking, for anyone that wants to pull their finger out and get connected and find a community online. I'm very excited about this at the moment. Thank you on that topic to a couple of people that emailed in to be my mega nerd. I'm going to be meeting a mega nerd tomorrow night. And we have got between us, we're going to talk about this, but there is a big webby project coming up for the show. I'm sorry, I know I'm going on, but this is important. We're going to try and make the Comedian's Comedian podcast easier to find online, easier to share, easier to listen to on whatever platform you want. And this whole process starts with you telling me what you want. So please join the thread at the Comedian's Comedian Facebook group and let me know how I could fit this show more snugly into your life. Hopefully, too, I'll make it easier to donate. Bam, there it is. I'm going to freestyle the pitch today. I'm going to try and do it in even less than a minute. Here goes. If you're enjoying the show, thank you so much for listening. I'd really appreciate a donation in support of it. Thank you to those of you who are doing that. And some people now have started to, even though you can't do an official repeat donation through PayPal, you can certainly go back to your computer every so often and pay me. So very, very many thanks to people who've done that. I do respond personally to all the donations, even if the bulk of that personal response has to be cut and pasted simply so I can write some jokes. But I do personalise where I can, and I thank you very much for your donations. Go to comedianscomedian.com, click on the PayPal donate button, which I think is very easy to see, but someone did email me and say they'd been looking for it for ages and it had taken them ages, so maybe that's a change we'll make. Big red flashing button in the middle of the screen. And you can donate a pound a show, 10, 15, 20 quid, whatever you think's appropriate. We're coming up for episode 100. So, I'm tentatively hoping that all of the rich kids out there have been saving up their £100 donations for a couple of weeks' time when we'll be releasing the Phil K episode that some of you might have already heard because I've leaked it in a sneaky way. It's a minute and 7 seconds, and I barely said everything I meant. But if you can donate, then you're paying for the people who can't afford to donate. And I appreciate that. I'm sure they do as well. If you can't donate, just share it with a friend. I mean, I've stopped the clock. It doesn't count. Coming up in future episodes, Louisa Omulan next week. Brilliant conversation, followed by Phil Kay. We've also got Andrew O'Neill in the can. That's coming up soon. I'm going to Dublin to interview comic ex-street performer and now movie star David McSavage on the 3rd of December at Trinity College. That's only for studios, but we're going to record and podcast that conversation. And this just in, Omid Jalili is coming up on the show as well. I'm recording that next week, so we'll sneak Omid in fairly soon as well. That is everything. Thanks for bearing with me as I rabbit about drag queens. I really recommend there's stuff to be learnt from looking at other forms and going, how does this person do it? How does that person do that? How can I apply this to add to my own stand-up practice? Now, back to... You didn't think I could out-talk Ross Noble, but apparently I can. Back to Ross.
Do you get to talk about your feelings on stage? Do you feel... What sort of self-expression do you have on stage? Other than you get to presumably have a whacking great adrenaline rush of like having a funny conversation with your mates when you're the funniest one and everyone's loving it.
Yeah.
Do you... Obviously, there's that element to your shows, because we're, again, for people that don't know you, you're very successful in the UK and in Australia, and you're playing big venues, you know, touring your own stuff with... Yeah. You know, able to the extent you can employ five comedy mates to come in there and be the touch paper pre-gig.
They do have jobs. Right? Yeah. I mean, they're not just... It's not entourage.
But you were... But is there an element to which you're expressing yourself other than simply getting pleasure from being funny?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that, you know, sometimes, you know, criticism that can be sort of levelled at me is, oh, you know, he doesn't really talk about sort of real things and, you know, how, you know, where's the dark side and all that stuff. But ultimately, I'm a very shallow person. That's not, you know, it's one of those things where... I'll talk about, I'm not that interested in, you know, as a person, I'm not the sort of person that sort of bangs on about how they're feeling all the time, you know, and if I'm, is that the question? I mean, it's one of those things where like, you know, basically me on stage is pretty much, it's exactly the same as me off stage, but I just dance around a bit more and, you know, people clap at the end of things rather than just going, oh, really? So I get to, that. I mean, I have, I'm, you know, if, you know, like if I see something on the news and it's, a sort of a heavy subject, I can go on and I can talk about that, but nobody will write a review of the show and go, sometimes, every now and again, but, you know, I can talk about something, but I can talk about really serious things. But if people are pissing themselves laughing, nobody comes away going, oh, well, he shared a bit, you know, and I can share things that are sort of, you know, perhaps a little dark or whatever, but nobody comes away going, because I don't go, and now I will share this with you. Yes. I just go, oh, yeah, and because that's exactly the same as I am off stage. If I've had something like, you know, if I've had something horrendous happen in my life, I'm more than likely just to go, oh, you know, this thing just happened, and, you know, rather than going, oh, look at me, I've got this, I'll just kind of, so I'll, you know, I can do that on stage, and people go, oh, there he is, just, and half the time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I just think I'm being either just being stupid, or they just go, oh, he's just making that up. And I go, yeah. No, that really happened, you know. So yeah, I've sort of got license because I'm just being myself. I've got license to do anything I want, you know.
Yeah.
But is that what you meant, or did you mean more about
about how you express yourself emotionally on stage? And was what the answer you seem to have given is that you don't need to express your emotional depth, say, on stage. You know, I'm just wondering about what you get out of it besides, like, listening to your gigs. They feel, I say listening, I've been listening to some on YouTube in the car illegally.
Oh, okay. Do you want to see the pictures of my kids?
But
they need feeding. Right, no.
But
I am joking, by the way. I'll sack one of the staff. No, go on, yeah, go on.
It seems to me that your gigs are like, the experience of you performing your gigs is more akin to like an extreme sport. Like, do you know what I mean? It's like, and you're a quite extreme sport sort of person. Like, you like riding a motorbike and racing and doing exciting, dangerous stuff. Is that similar to your gig? Is it like, is there a sort of, you know, adrenaline junkie feel to it? Because we can talk more about the writing process, process,
yeah, yeah.
But it seems like I think to the casual observer, the gig is 100% freefall, or 95% freefall in the story at the end.
It's interesting that you say that about that sort of adrenaline thing. I always liken, Yeah, because I'm into motorbikes, it's quite a good analogy. In fact, that's what I do. Like, in the daytime, I've got, like, we've got me and my tour manager. One of the reasons he's my tour manager is we have our dirt bikes and we go off and we find places. So we ride all day. And then, so if you ever come to one of my gigs, as happened the other day, and I'm doing a lot of stuff about people limping. Probably a reason why I did a gig the other night and I smashed my leg up, and all the way through the show I had like lizard people crawling around on the stage. Oh, I'll do that, that'll work. I was on the blower. And then people hop. There's a lot of people hopping and stuff. It's because my leg kept going into a spasm. But if you watch the show to somebody who if people are putting themselves in my position, they're watching the show and they're going, oh my God, this is, oh, what if, and there's just this sort of like going, oh, but if this, what if this goes wrong? Oh, he's dug himself into a hole for himself. Oh, he's trying to get out of it. Oh, no, he's painted himself into a corner. He's dug a hole and then painted himself into the corner of the hole. And that's to the casual observer, they're putting themselves in my position going, you know, they're sitting there looking around going, 2,000 people in this theatre, and what if I was in that position? But that's not what I'm thinking. Yeah. In my head, it's exactly the same as, you know, if you get, you know, driving a car, riding a motorbike, first time you get on a bike, you know, trying to work out what all the levers and pedals and stuff, you do it right, you know, and that, you know, it's like driving a car, you know, you're sort of like, right, is that finding the gear and the letting it, and it's this, like this clunky thing where you have to think about it, and then you're driving along and, you know, there's people going past you fast and it's freaking you out, and then just slowly over time you start to get used to it, and then, you know, you get to the point where you're driving with your knees and you're eating a sandwich and you're changing a CD, and it's just that, you know, and then you've sort of hit the nail on the head, that thing, if you want to drive a bit faster, and it's not enough just to, you know, just to sort of drive down the road, you're sort of there going, oh, I wonder what would happen if I just drove over that, and then, yeah. And also, like, you know, for me, if I'm on a roll, I want that audience to be, I want them to be like that, like keeping up with me, you know, there's nothing worse than going, blah, 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 and then going, well, you know, and just not being, just the energy's not at the right, you want to be like that, you want to just be, so yeah, there's an element of that, but that's not me going, that's not me walking on stage and going, I have to do something death defying, let's go on stage and go, I've got this room full of people. Where can this go? What can I do with this? It's like a, you know, rather than me going, oh, let's throw myself off a cliff. It's more just going, wee. It's that. That's what it is. I go wee and just, you know, and just yeah, going with it. If that makes sense. Yeah.
So. Just to stay with this analogy of it as a motorbike or a car. As a young comic are kind of getting onto the motorbike for the first time, and going, right, these are the things. What sort of tools are we talking about? What sort of things are you learning between your 100th gig and your 500th gig? What sort of structures are you using? Like, for example, I might watch one of your gigs and go, okay, he's asked this person about that. He spent 5 minutes on this person. So that's a decision to have stayed with that for a long time. I've noticed you very rarely find out a thing without then, you know, if you ask someone in the audience what they do for a living, you very rarely go, oh, right, great, and move on. Stay with it and you mine it. And then I might watch and go, okay, later you'll be in the middle of a, you know, 20 minutes later you'll be doing something else and you'll clearly go, there's a link here, bang, bring that in.
So
do you know what I mean? So those sorts...
But those things, the thing is, though, that those things change all the time, you know? That's just depending on mood. Like, there's some nights where I'll talk to somebody and I think, you know, I'll be in the mood to talk to one person and do, you know, like, it's all about them. And then other times I think, oh, no, I quite fancy flitting around a bit more. And that's usually dependent on what the show has been the previous night, you know? Because if it's been one thing, I kind of go, oh, well, I've got to, you know, I want it to be a different vibe. Otherwise, it can just get a bit samey, you know. Those decisions, they're changing all the time. It can be, you know, like sometimes if there's too many things going on, people can over concentrate and they get tired. So mm-hmm. sometimes you kind of want to, but they're all like, that's all.
The sort of instinctive micro decisions almost.
Yeah, sometimes I just think, oh, hang on, if I go into something and I think, oh, this is, you know, if it feels a bit, sometimes I think, oh, this feels a bit obvious. I'll get into something and think, oh, this is working. And I just kind of go, oh, this is probably going down this particular path. And I go, yeah, stuff it. And then I go over. Sometimes I just get distracted or forget what I'm talking about. Mm. But the thing is, all of that comes from, a lot of it comes from, and you're going to love this when I tell you this. You're going to go, don't say that. The regulars are going to be furious, right? But when I started, right, you ready for this? I was a street entertainer.
Turn off your device now.
So before I did stand up, when I was I started doing stand up when I was 15, but before that, from cut a long story short, because people have heard this, but when I was 11. I'm dyslexic, right? I was terrible at school. They didn't find out I was dyslexic until I was 11 or 12. And I realised at that point I was, you know, I could barely write. I was hopeless academically. So I decided that I was going to get a job where I didn't have to write anything down. And I thought, I need to get a job. I need to get some sort of skill that you can go, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it had to be an actual tangible thing. And I sort of racked my brains to try and come up with what that could be. And then through a long, several sort of odd things that happened, I sort of became obsessed with circuses. So I learned to juggle and ride a unicycle. And then myself and a mate started busking. And we...
Where was this?
This is up in Newcastle.
Okay, gotcha.
And then so we would go to... we got to Newcastle, and then we got a job with a guy who sold balloons, and we travel around the country. Then when we were 14, we do kids parties as well, and then so from the age of like 12, I would like turn up in Newcastle City Centre, do a show, pass the bucket around, right, and there was a garden festival, Gateshead Garden mm-hmm. Festival, so I got a gig there, and we entertain the queues of people who are coming in to, you know, like the queue up to go into like a healthy eating exhibition. Yeah. So we'd be on the stage and we'd do the show, and then every 5 minutes the audience would go in and then another queue would line up, and it was all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I became obsessed with buskers and circuses and all that sort of stuff. So I did that. Until I was 15. And then my plan was, I was going to move to London, and I had this all planned out. I was going to move to London. I was going to get a job as a toy demonstrator at Hamleys, mm-hmm. right? Because I thought, well, it's the perfect gig. So I was going to do that. I was going to get the gig doing that, and then I was going to become a busker in London, and I was going to get a gig with a circus. I was going to travel the world as a circus performer. Well, anyway, as it happens, I won tickets to see a comedy show, saw a stand-up, went, that's the gig, that's what I should be doing. So then I was going to wait until I was 18. I thought, stuff, I went and did a gig when I was 15. And I thought, well, I'll just do it as a hobby until I'm 18, and then I'll make it my job, and then I'll move to London and blah, blah. Anyway, when I was 15, I started getting gigs. So I did my first open spot, and somebody came up and went, oh, we've got a gig up the road.
Yeah.
Do you want a gig? So I went, all right then. So I went and did that gig, and then somebody at that gig went, oh, well, we run this other gig. So I went and did an open spot. The next week I was comparing.
Yeah.
So it literally, like, it just went, like, straight away. And then, so I spent 3 years up in Newcastle, just travelling around the country, doing like uni gigs, and because I was because I started in Newcastle, because at the time there weren't any. I think the Glee Club had just opened here in Birmingham. That was the only like comedy club outside of London. So there was loads of gigs, and there just wasn't enough acts. And if you brought an act up from London, it cost loads of money to put them up and all that. So if you were up in the north, it was like, and it was still sort of the end of the, the sort of alternative thing. So you'd do gigs where it was like, it was people like loads of poets on, you know, so you're like John Cooper Clarke and John Otway and Hovis Presley and even like Dave Gorman. When Dave Gorman first started out, he was a poet, and you know, it was all that sort of, it was still very much, you know, the idea of alternative comedy, even though it was the early 90s, this idea of you had Ben Elton and you had the Dickie Bowtie Mob, and Billy Connolly, obviously. Yeah. But so because of that, I was doing a regular compere. Like, I used to do this gig in York, and it was mad. It was like, you know, you'd have sort of like, it was people, you know, Fred McCauley was big at the time, like Joe Brand and Lee Evans and all these people, you know, in sort of 100-seater room in York, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But all these people were coming. So all I saw was the absolute best acts that were coming up from the London circuit. And then, I mean, obviously the locals as well, but I just thought everyone in London was phenomenal. It was just this weird thing. I sort of lived in this bubble of kind of, you know, I was seeing people like, you know, like my early gigs. It was like, you know, Boothby Graffo, Sean Locke, Harry Hill, you know, Bill Bailey. Well, still in the Rubber Bishops, but you know, it was all these people who were like the absolute top of the circuit, you know. So I had this idea that London was this sort of like insane, like everyone in London was just, you know, knocking it out of the park, you know, the best acts you could get, you know. So I thought I'll stay out of London for ages. So because I stayed up in the north and I did loads of comparing, I was going back to clubs really regularly. So I had this thing of my idea, you know, it wasn't that thing of like, I never fell into that thing of going, you get 5 minutes and you do your 5 minutes and you hone it and you hone it and you hone it. So it wasn't really the opportunity. I mean, you could, but it was that thing of like every gig you'd go, oh, I'll come up with new stuff. I'll talk about something else. And there wasn't any sort of idea of it being, you know, you work on your, there was no, the idea of honing your act wasn't,
yes.
That was never, it was about how do I make this audience laugh?
Sure.
Rather than how do I create an act that, you know.
Yes. It was only, the job in hand was only ever to make up something afresh and get them laughing.
Yeah. And it was just to go and do the gig. There was no sense of like, you know, oh, this must be incredibly honed because I need to get this gig again. And obviously the people who are coming up from London, you are seeing these phenomenally, just these, you know, acts that were at the absolute top of their game. But at the same time, you still had the sort of remnants of the alternative thing where people were just turning up doing characters, and you'd see somebody the next week and he'd come on with a bag on his head, and then somebody would just, you know, he'd come on in drag, and it was like, you know, there was people just doing all this sort of just still what you would deem like alternative stuff, you know. So it was in this weird mixture of, so my kind of influences, sorry, I should probably hang on, let me chuck that phone. So
Ross has just thrown his expensive phone across his large hotel room.
Oh God, no! That makes me look like a right now, doesn't it?
If anyone would like to listen to the distance between the noise of him throwing it and the noise of it landing, you can work out the size of the room.
There'll be somebody that'll do that. And I nearly killed that horse as well. So that's basically. So then, when I moved to London, 95, I arrived in London and went, we were only getting the best acts, you see?
Actually, everyone here is less good than I thought, and I've been training in secret for years doing new stuff.
Yeah, and then so
Did you have contemporaries in Newcastle who were thinking the same thing and learning the same way? Because it does seem like that's quite a specific... Like, surely everyone up north can't have been doing a completely new 5 or 10 or 20 every time.
No, but there was certainly... there was certainly a sort of... I'm trying to think who the other sort of people around in... I think there was definitely a sense of doing something. It was all about doing something a bit different. It was more the feeling of that you get where people are working towards Edinburgh, but without the idea of ever going to Edinburgh.
Oh God! Imagine how good the circuit would be if everyone worked towards an Edinburgh that never happened.
So that's how. So I'm sort of trying to explain it as quickly as possible. So I got to London, and then obviously, because I'd been doing all the comparing, and because I'd sort of, and that was the other thing. My early act, you can still hear that Ford in the distance, because my early act still had the sort of leftovers from my juggling. Mm-hmm. At times, so I would pull out some tricks.
You do props on stage?
Yeah, no, I was a prop act. That's when I first. And in fact, there was one of those. There was a thing. That was the other thing as well. Probably about 3 or 4 months when I was 15, just after I started, and there was a guy. They used to Tyne Tees telly. He used to do kid shows from Tyne Tees. He came along and just went, "Oh, do you want to work on the show?" So I'd only been going about 3 months, and I was writing and performing sketches on like live telly, Saturday morning kids TV.
What was the show called?
A show called Gimme Five.
I can't remember that.
It was on at the same time as Going Live, which is why no one watched it.
Yeah, okay.
But it was
the ITV.
Yeah, the terrible ITV version. It was with Nobby the Sheep.
Yeah, I remember that. That's going back.
So I did that. So all of a sudden, I was just getting all this, you know, the sort of.
Did that have the Vicious Boys on it?
That was Get Fresh.
That was Get Fresh.
That was Get Fresh with Gilbert the Alien, so because of that. I didn't have that. I never had that idea of do your 5 minutes, you get your 5 minutes together, you do your 10, go to 20, work your way up. It never happened. And then when I moved to London, I just hit the ground running because I turned up and everyone went, "God, this open spot's good, isn't he?"
Yeah.
And and it's that thing of like, but I'd already been up north just, you know, playing around. So I got to London, and then very quickly I got loads of work comparing, and then I started doing loads of TV warm-ups.
I think Acaster told me recently that you had kind of almost made a strategic decision to do warm-up rather than commercial clubs like Jonglers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the money was much better, and you get loads more stage time. And,
And you were in a TV studio as well.
Yeah.
So what I would do is I'd do the warm-up, and then as soon as they were ready to go, I used to hang around and just watch what was going on,
mm-hmm.
learn about, you know, just sort of get in the way. But, you know, that thing of just like watch what people were doing, you know, watch the way that they were doing things, just sort of, you know, ask, you know, why is that happening? What's going on? Working out. And also just getting comfy in a TV studio as well, you know. Like by the time, because I turned down telly, partly because of the... because of the whole kids TV thing, and I sort of realised what the way that telly works and stuff, so I just turned down everything, and then deliberately kept away from telly for a long time. And part
when you say the way that telly works, what was it that made you
just the fact that, you know, you've got to, you know, if you're, well, it depends what you're doing on telly, but you know, this the thing with telly is everything's done by committee. You know, you've got even things that you come up with an idea. And, you know, even if it's your idea, you know, even if it's your show, your idea, you know, you're you know, you have the final say over it. It's still got, you've still got to explain that idea to, you've still got to explain that idea to, you know, the director. Even if you're directing it yourself, you still have to explain to all the camera guys what's happening, say how it's going to be shot, how it's going to, you know, you've got to tell the lighting guy what, how you want it to look and all that. So all of these things, you know, it can be good, but also, you know, if you're doing a show that isn't your show, it's very easy for, you can do the most brilliant, you know, you can do the most brilliant thing on the night in a studio, and all it takes is for the idiot that's editing it not to, just to have no timing, and you look like you're not funny, you know? So it just sort of made me realise that you've got to, if you're not careful, and also telly's, it's, you're not your own, you know, you're not your own master in telly, you know? It's one of those things where your, the decision isn't being made on whether or not something's funny or not. It's so many other factors that are coming into play, you know? But by the time I did do telly, I'd done so much time doing warm-ups that, you know, I could walk into a TV studio, and whereas a lot of people would be going, oh my God, there's cameras on and there's a thing, and, and there was a sense of occasion, there was no sense of occasion for me at all, because I just walk in and go, I've been in this room hundreds of times before, and these are the same crew, and they, you know, and then somebody else is doing the warm-up, and you sat there going, well, they're doing the work, and, you know. So, yeah, and I did that. I decided that I would do... I mean, I still did the commercial clubs, but just not, again, I wasn't a slave to it, you know. It just sort of like, if I did three warm-ups a week, that was the, you know, that I could live off that, you know, and, you know, so I did that. And then through doing the warm-ups, then when it came to me doing my own show, it's one of those things where I'd kind of done it all on my own terms. So by the time I was doing a show, you could say it would have been much slicker if I'd have gone a different route. But that's just, I just got used to doing it a particular way. And then I started doing my own shows, and then there wasn't that sense of going, oh, you know, I wasn't going, oh, it has to be this, this and this. It was just, it is what it is, you know.
Did you find that you did get noticed by TV production people doing warm-ups? Because it's every comic's nightmare is that, you know, that, and I forget the story, I forget who this happened to now. Well, I've talked about it with a couple of guests, that they would come along and go, oh, we need a comedian. You're a comedian. Do you know anyone? Because there's this sense that actually, as a warm-up, I've done lots of warm-up of different sorts, and sometimes you feel like, oh, I'm a member of the sound department, and the people in the production box aren't even listening to my feed.
They're not, but that's what you've sort of got to realise, is the fact that, like, I try, whenever I'm doing a show, I try to go down a bit earlier and at least watch at least say hello to the warm-up, you know, see what's going on, see what the vibe is in the room. But no, and I used to kind of go, oh, the warm-up's like the lowest of the low. You're not, it's just nobody, you're dead right. No, nobody's sitting in the gallery thinking about, you know, the bloke is changing the batteries in the the microphone. It's not that they don't think you're doing a great job, because, you know, if you have a terrible warm-up, everyone knows about it. But it's just that thing of like, you know, and it's, you know, if you go and sit in a gallery, you know, while the show is being recorded, you can't hear the warm up. It's just background noise. All they can hear is the audience laughing. Nobody's going, oh, I wonder what he's doing. So it's not that they...
So the value to you was in actually just acclimatising yourself to a studio, learning all of that stuff, rather than any kind of career advancement.
But actually it worked the opposite. It had the opposite thing. I started getting offered work because people would go, oh, he's good. So all of a sudden I was being offered, like, it was like I was being sort of, the doors were opening with telly people, but to do the sort of things I didn't necessarily want to be doing, you know.
God, what sort of things?
Well, just sort of like, you know, I used to do, you know, like if I would do a warm-up for a panel show and then I would be offered the chance to go on that panel show and I would turn it down and they would go, why? And I go, because that's not really what I want to do. That's not my, you know. And that's quite, that was quite tricky when, you know, people would go, oh, wow, yay, we think you're great. Come and do it. And I go, no.
Yeah, that, just, I mean, that's a really brave decision. You can, I mean, we can see now that you've reaped the benefits of that, but because you are someone that does it on your own terms, that tours terms, that lives where you want to live, and you know, dirt bikes during the day and all the rest of it.
Exactly,
you know, you've made it sounds like you've made exactly the life and the career that you wanted.
100%.
How did you turn it down? How did you say to someone, hey, thanks for the opportunity, I know I'm a comic and you book comics, I don't want to be on your show?
Because... partly because of what I learned in, you know, having done telly very, very early on up in Newcastle, and partly just because, you know, I'm a raging megalomaniac who felt that that was beneath me.
But how did you actually say to the casting people or to the producers? Did you just had to look them in the eye and go, oh, guys, thanks, but it's not my thing?
No, basically, I just did that thing, just going, I don't want to do telly. Yeah. And they go, what? What do you mean you don't do that? And I just, well, I don't really do
telly. Suddenly there is an enigma over this young guy. But,
and it wasn't a thing, you know, and it was sort of, it was just that thing of, when I started out, I knew that all I've ever wanted, you know, since the early days, is I've wanted to tour. I wanted to be a touring comic where, you know, the people that, you know, like growing up, I didn't, you know, I used to love the TV comics, but the people who I loved were people like Billy Connolly and Jasper Carrot and, you know, people like Richard Digance and people like that who went on in a theatre with a room full of people and did their show.
Mm.
And that's all I've wanted, you know, I wasn't thinking, oh, well, that could get me... this, that, or the other. It was never a stepping stone for me. That's always been the end game. And the other thing is as well, what I realised is that whatever you do on telly, if you get known for that, it's very hard to then, you know, it's in a way, I mean, I'm not slagging them off at all, but it's like Russell Brand, you know? Like, you know, Russell Brand is now decided that he's going to be Lenny Bruce or Bill Hicks or something. And it's one of those things where that's very difficult if you've got famous for presenting Big Brother spin-off shows, you know, shagging supermodels and being a frivolous, you know, being some sort of, you know, if you got famous not for your hard-hitting stand-up.
Yes.
That's not to say that I think Russell's brilliant and I love him a bit and I think he's an incredibly talented bloke. But it's the same way that, like, you know, if you're going to be, you know, if you want to be a movie star, then probably best not doing a soap. I mean, I know there's exceptions to the rule, you know.
It's almost like what Russell needs to do is go into the desert for 10 years and then when he comes back, he's allowed to...
Exactly, because, but it's sort of like you have to, you know, and some people can sort of reinvent themselves, but going back to Sean Hughes, I'm going to get so much trouble for this. But, you know, it's one of those things where you have to set yourself in, and it's one of those things where now, if somebody comes along and sees my show... And just go, hang on a second, this is just a bloke dicking about for a couple of hours. The only reason that that's acceptable is because it's not like I never did stand up and then I was on, I don't know, whatever, the Strictly Come Dancing or something, and then went, oh, I think I'll do that now. I just think it's one of those things where, and I sort of knew back then, that if I became one of those sort of ubiquitous sort of TV faces, that then ultimately that's all you end, you know. It's very hard to break out of that.
Integrity, basically, is what you're describing. People come and...
Can't you put it like that?
Yeah, but I think it is. If people come to... People know what they're going to get. I mean, they know... I don't mean to suggest that that's boring. They trust you.
Exactly.
And the more of your stuff I watched and listened to, the more I realised that this is going to sound. Let me pick my way around this sentence.
What?
The content doesn't matter because it's no, you. You're right. It's you. That's what we want to see. Exactly. We want to see you overreach yourself or appear to get things together. We want to see you jump off the cliff. We want to see you save yourself at the last minute.
But integrity, you know, because it's one of those things where, you know, I'm not one of these people that would, look at somebody that does adverts and you know, corporate gigs or whatever and sort of go, oh, you shouldn't do that. Personally, you know, I've done the odd voiceover in the past, you know. My ceiling fell in at one point and I was a bit skint at the time. And I went, I need a couple of grand to fix that ceiling that I don't need. So, you know, I was the voice of a talking remote control for a cable and satellite week, you know. That's, you know, I don't have a problem with people doing that sort of stuff.
It's just that for you, it doesn't fit into the plan.
It just doesn't fit. Because also as well, from my point of view, you know, like at the end of, you know, at the end of the show, you know, when I open it up and ask if there's any questions, you know, if I'm the face of, you know, Dairy Lee Dunkers, you know, I can't walk down the street and have people like going, "Hey, Dairy Lee," because it just completely undermines the, you know, anything you do. I think you have to live with it because you will never live it down. You know, it's like Lenny Henry. You know, I loved Lenny Henry when I was a kid. And, you know, I think he's done Shakespeare and he's done all this sort of, like, you know, he's been this massive, you know, he's done Hollywood movies, he's done stand up, he's done all this for, and now he's the bloke off the Premier Inn advert.
Yeah,
and as soon as you do, and it's fine, and I've got not, you know, and it's one of those things where I really like Lenny Henry. I think he's an incredibly talented bloke, but it's one of those things where, for me, if I walked out on stage and I have to deal with, people.
Well, you're the Premier Inn.
Where you stand, you know. So that, you know, you've just got to live, and that's my approach to. It's my approach to every decision I make in terms of, like, career-wise. It's all based on, you should never do anything for the money or the fame, because as soon as you start doing it for that, then it's completely, you'll always come a cropper, because it's just, you're just going, it's the wrong way to do it, you know? So I always, every decision I do is this going to be fun, and how is this going to affect it? Is this in the long run? If I do a TV show that is going to, for example, right, if I get offered a telly show that's going to reach an incredibly broad audience, I have to look at that and go, the downside of that, I know a lot of people look at it and go, wow, if I do this, loads of people will see me and they'll buy a ticket. Yeah. I look at it and go, if I do this, loads of people will see me and buy a ticket. You don't want those people coming along, because if they think you're hilarious as the wacky neighbour in a sitcom, if you come
they're
out...
They're going to come along and be disappointed.
Exactly, because that's not what they're going to get. And it's a very fine line between, you know, you can... Like, for example, there's people who can walk down the street and be constantly, constantly hassled all the time, can't sell a ticket live.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the tricky thing of when you get into, you know, when you get into that, that's what I mean by you got to be careful with telly, because it's brilliant, but at the same time, you've just got to be careful, because telly's not interested in what it can do for you. It's all about just going, all right, we'll have that. It just feeds it, you know. And it's exactly the same as a live thing. You have to let it work for you, you know. It has to work that way around. So.
So that was Ross Noble. Part two coming up next week, so I'll speak to you then. Thank you very much to Olivia Phipps for the Podmin, Nathan Wood for co-production, and thanks to Ross for being so forthcoming and totally ignoring his salad niçoise in order to talk to me. That's all for now. I was far too chatty earlier on. Tweet me at ComComPod. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you like, and I will speak to you next week. Bye for now.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.